see what's happening, but this guy just put a big clock down in front of me as if time really matters here. What is that? Now Ralph told me we'd be done by 2 or 2:30. He didn't say I'd be starting at 2:35. So I think we're going for a new record this afternoon. No? Oh, okay. See, what do I know? I have really enjoyed. That was an amazing introduction. Thank you very much. That was very warm and honest and real. And all I can say is thank you, Michael, for inviting me to those lunches. And thank you. I always sit next to Ralph, always. And he helps me order. That's right. He shows me what the good stuff is. But I've really enjoyed getting to know both of you guys, as well as the larger group from Tikkun and some of the others who come. It's been really good. I haven't been there in a long time because I spent about 5 months in Israel, just got back in December. I'm so glad that I'm in a place where I don't have to at least too much explain Jews for Jesus. You know, when I go to a church and I speak and I say Jews for Jesus, I tell them, I realize to you it sounds like vegetarians for beef. But, I mean, I was just in rural Tennessee for 2 weeks, and this was over and over again. I was in the poorest county in Kentucky and in a little country church, you know, but here I don't have to explain such things, so that's very good. I don't want to go on at length about my story. You've invited me to tell a little of my story, so I'll just tell you in a nutshell. I'm from the Chicago area. I was raised in a conservative synagogue. My dad's side of the family was Orthodox. My mom's side was Jewish as far back as you can go, but not religious. My great-grandfather was a kosher butcher, but when the dishwasher was invented, my grandma stopped keeping kosher. And then, well, you know how it sterilizes and no blood. When I married my Gentile wife, my grandfather on that side said, well, he's going to give Laura a little lesson on Jewish culture. He said, now, Laura, we Jews don't eat pork, only bacon. And I was there to hear him say that. So, you know, so you could say I'm from a mixed marriage, you know, Orthodox and kind of liberal Jewish. And so we belonged to a conservative synagogue, and I did all the kinds of things a typical Jewish kid in America does. Go to synagogue, Hebrew school after school, Sunday school, learn the blessings, learn to, you know, all the Torah portions, the Haftarah, all that kind of stuff. Bar mitzvah. But like most Jewish homes, it wasn't a religious Jewish home. We didn't talk about God. We didn't talk about faith. We sure didn't read the Bible. We did have one, I think, up on the shelf somewhere. So when my Orthodox grandmother died and I was 17, she and I were pretty tight. I used to go there for lunch every day when I was a kid in elementary school, and we were very close. And so this was the first real, you know, kind of painful loss in my life. So I started thinking about life and death and why are we here? What's the meaning of life? And started going on my own search. Is life all about making a lot of money? Is it getting high and going to parties? What is the meaning of life? Couldn't find it. Thought life had no meaning, actually. And went off to the University of Illinois. And in my, I was going to be the next Bob Dylan. I'll just throw that in there. But that's a rabbit trail. And in my first semester there, I wound up writing a research paper for a Jewish professor on why the Jews at the time of Jesus didn't believe he was the Messiah. So I had to see, what did our people expect? Why didn't they think Jesus fit? And I didn't know any, you know, in my synagogue, we didn't talk about the Messiah. Zip. So I had to see, what did they expect? And so I looked at those prophetic passages, right, in the Tanakh that our sages had said were about the Messiah. And new material. So I read explanations, books by Jewish authors and Christian authors and secular authors who compared ancient manuscripts. I had so many questions, so I thought, I really got into it. So I'm going to go talk and hear both sides. So I interviewed two rabbis, you know, one at a time, two rabbis and two Christian pastors to hear both sides, give them equal time. And they all tried to be helpful. They weren't all helpful, but they tried to be helpful. Actually, there was one rabbi and one pastor had more heart, and the other two were kind of like out there. But you know, I started leaning in the direction that it could be true. Obviously, you see where I am today, so I ultimately concluded it's true. But when you start, now, I don't know how many of you grew up in a Jewish home. I look around and I'm thinking, some of you, okay? And maybe not a few of you. But you've been hanging around here long enough that you probably absorbed the ethos of a Jewish home. I mean, my latest analogy is that every home has a radar screen in it, like an air traffic controller. And on your radar screen in your home is everything that's important to you. You grow up in a Christian home, you've got church and Bible and God, Jesus, you've got maybe family there, you know, and you've got all that stuff. And in a Jewish home, on the radar screen, you've got Israel, intermarriage, assimilation, Jewish education, all of those things. But of course, Yeshua, he ain't on the screen. He's not in the home. We don't think about him. We don't talk about him. He doesn't exist, essentially, as long as we can keep it that way. And so the only time I heard his name was when my mother was angry, and she would take his name in vain. You know, she would say, Jesus Christ, all the time. And so I finished my paper. I quit school for about a year to do the Dylan thing. It didn't get that far, though. And my wife, but my Gentile girlfriend, who had, this is a whole nother story, but I'll just take 1 minute and tell you. When I started writing that paper in the fall semester at school, my girlfriend Laura had been raised in a Finnish-speaking Pentecostal home. All right, her family are immigrants from Finland. All right, very conservative denomination. She had the whole immigrant experience. And when we got together the summer after high school, although we knew each other since sixth grade, she was sayonara, and that's not Finnish, but you know, sayonara to religion. To church, to family, I'm through with all that. She thought her family just wasn't in touch with the important things. So we got together. So she's running, okay, in her words, she would say she's running from Jesus, thinking she's safe with this Jewish guy, right? You know? I start writing a paper about him, and she, without telling me at that time, she's inwardly freaking out. But anyway, a few months after I quit school, I go to her house one day, and she says, hey, guess what happened? Jesus and I got together last night. That's how she put it. It was the 70s, yes. And so I began to see her life change, get better, you know, I mean, incrementally, positive ways. And I got to the point where I just began, when I was alone, if there's a God, show me. I was an agnostic, you know, uncertain. You know, there's two kinds of agnostics, right? I'll tell you what they are. One says, I don't know if there's a God. Maybe there's a God, I just don't know. The other one says, if there's a God, he is unknowable. All right? There's two kinds. I was the first one. I thought maybe there's a God, but I don't know. So I began to pray, show me if there's a God. If this is true about Jesus, I didn't know the name Yeshua at that point. If this is true about Jesus, I'm willing to find out. And make a long story shorter, I found out. I mean, because you know that God will answer that prayer. Most of you know that. He said, when you seek for me with all your heart, I will be found. So he was found. I found him. He revealed himself to me. And that was 1975. I prayed a prayer to receive him into my life for the forgiveness of sins. And it's been an adventure ever since then. And I am really glad. You're going to have to just like flip it around. It doesn't matter. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
I just learned to ignore it.
Yeah. You have more experience. Anyway, I'm really glad to be here. I discussed with Ralph that I'll tell you a little more about Jews for Jesus as we get into the Word a little bit. I'll share stories and anecdotes. And you'll get a feel for the kinds of things that we do. Have any of you seen us in the D.C. area before? Okay. I know I met Lemuel at the Tacoma Park Metro Station years ago. I think I don't know what year it was, but, and was it something like that? 2008, maybe. All right. But I want to offer our newsletter, essentially. And if you want our newsletter, I figured I got the perfect bribe. I don't, you know, we're not supposed to bribe, but it's okay. This is my testimony. It's just all the details and, you know, the longer story and photos and long hair and beards and all kinds of that stuff like that. If you would like a free copy, I'll have someone from our office send this to you if you just give us your info on an index card. So I don't know how to get these around. I'll just give them to you. Thanks. If you want our newsletter and you want a copy of my testimony, and by the way, I wrote this not with you in mind. Seriously, I wrote it with non-believing Jewish people in mind. So if you want a tool that you can share with somebody, you can give them my story, and it'll keep a conversation going. Let me read you a story, short story, true story, of a girl in Israel named Mor. Dahlia, did you meet Mor ever? Okay. Until January, I oversaw our ministry's work in Israel for about the last dozen years, and I would go there very frequently for different lengths of time. And I know this girl, and she's 19 years old. I'm going to read it. It'll be clearer that way. She grew up in an Orthodox family in Petah Tikva, not far from Tel Aviv. When she was 14, a rabbi who works with an anti-missionary organization came to her school and spoke about the dangerous missionaries and missions and that the students should not talk with Jews for Jesus. All right, Yudim Leman Yeshua over there. This made Mor, remember that's her name, it's a strange name in America, but it's common there. This made Mor so curious that she went to our website and started to read about Yeshua. After reading the articles, pamphlets, and testimonies she found there, she believed Yeshua's claims to be our Messiah. She ordered some of our books, but her parents found them and didn't let her read them. They sent her to different rabbis so they could convince her not to believe, but Mor secretly continued to study about Yeshua on the internet. When she was 17, so this is now 3 years later, she saw us holding up banners during one of our Behold Your God campaigns and had the courage to order books from us. Behold Your God campaigns. In about 2001, we began these large-scale evangelism campaigns in every city outside of Israel throughout the whole world that has a Jewish population of 25,000 or more to try to reach our people wherever they are. And then in 2008, we began in Israel, and we're still in the midst of that. We're going to do 12 campaigns in Israel, each in a different geographic center or population center. So this fall, for instance, we're going to be in the Negev. But so she saw us when she was 17. Once again, her parents intercepted all the books but one, a book called Korim Lo Yeshua, which means his name is Yeshua, and it's a book about the messianic prophecies. So like round two, her parents called different rabbis to talk with Mor. But Mor didn't lose her faith. She waited, since she knew she couldn't meet with us till she was 18. In Israel, it's illegal to talk to evangelize minors, to talk to minors about religious things. So she did call us, and we said, we can't talk to you. Call us when you're 18. The day she turned 18, she emailed us that she wanted to meet with us. Yarden, we have a couple on our staff, Peter and Yarden Nasser, all right? Yarden made Aliyah as maybe about 11 years old, 13 years old. I don't even know how old she was. She came from the Ukraine on her own. So did her brother, but they came at separate times, go figure. And she married Peter Nasser. Now, if you remember the Six-Day War, there was a bad guy in Egypt with the name Nasser, right? Nasser is an Arabic name. She married, his real name is Betrabus Nasser. He's an Arab Christian, but a true believer. They got married. They're on our staff. This Arab guy does Jewish evangelism. And so if he can do that, what's your excuse? All right. but anyway, so they write, this is them, their words, by the way. Yarden and I began to meet with her to disciple her, but because her parents were suspicious that she might be in contact with us, it was hard to stay in touch with her. Her parents disconnected their internet service, but we continued to communicate with Moore and disciple her through text messages sent by phone. It wasn't the easiest or best way, as we sometimes spent hours explaining different things to her through text messages, but it was worth it. Eventually, her mom found the New Testament in their home and again called different rabbis, but this time Moore didn't hide her faith and told her parents about her beliefs. Life at home became very difficult. All the problems in the family suddenly became her fault, and her parents tried to make her stop believing. Tried everything to make her stop believing. Finally, they insisted, if you want to continue living in this house, you cannot mention Yeshua. We don't want to hear anything about him, and we don't want to see you reading about him, or you will need to leave our house. All right. Why did I read that story? Well, not only to tell you something about Moore, and if she comes to mind, you can pray for her. Interestingly, she's back with her father right now. But she went to live with Peter and Yarden. She was there for several months until just recently. But usually our home is a safe haven, right? I mean, you know, if it's a functional as opposed to dysfunctional home, and we all have different experiences. Some of us grew up in a dysfunctional home, but if it's a functional home, it's a, except for little arguments now and then, you know, it's a generally a warm place. You have the holidays there. You have nice meals there. Recreation and good memories are formed there. Because of her faith, she had to leave her home. And, you know, if I can extend that concept of home to be a little bit bigger, and interestingly enough, it's been mentioned in this service a couple times today, the word camp. Hey, thanks a lot. The word camp. You know, you think of the camp of Israel. What was the camp of Israel? Let me just turn a few pages over here. The camp of Israel was the community of Israel. You know, inside the camp, if you're inside the camp, that's a good place to be. It can be where you have those family memories. It can be where you have those holiday celebrations, where you have worship experiences, where you experience the presence of God. You know, it's a place of respectability, a place of security, safety, familiarity. The culture feels right. The traditions are yours. You know, so if you're inside the camp, it's kind of like being in this service today. There's been a sense here for the last several hours of being inside a shelter here. And we all feel really good in here. It's familiar and it's warm and it's loving and we've been hugging and singing and dancing. And it's really good in here. If we export this to the streets somewhere, it's a little more vulnerable. You're not exactly feeling like you're in the camp out there, you know? And yet Jewish believers in Jesus, in Yeshua, have an interesting, and actually it extends to all believers in Yeshua. There's an interesting verse. You've been preaching out of Hebrews, right? Where are you in Hebrews now? Do you remember? 6. Well, I'm going to jump to 13. Hebrews chapter 13. And I'm really going to read one verse. You've already explained. I'm sure you all know that the book of Hebrews, or the letter of Hebrews, actually, there are many who think it wasn't a letter, that it was a prolonged sermon. There's lots of reasons to think that Hebrews was originally preached and taught rather than a circular letter. But it was intended to go to the early Messianic Jews, the Messianic Jews that had a lot of pressure on them to return to Judaism for lots of reasons. All right, we're not going to go into all that background. You've probably already been there. But near the end of the letter, which you're not there yet, but this is a sneak peek of something that'll come. He makes a statement in the last, he most likely, we don't really know who wrote Hebrews, you know that. But chapter 13, verse 13, it says this, "Hence," or "therefore, let us go out to him," speaking of Yeshua, "outside the camp, bearing his reproach." All right? He goes through this whole thing and he sums it up there with this call, this invitation, this challenge, whatever you want to say. Let's go out to him, Yeshua, who's outside the camp, being willing to bear his reproach, the abuse that he experienced. And it's not just the sole privilege of Jewish believers. You know, those of you who aren't Jewish, I've known in the Messianic movement, I don't know if you call yourselves Messianic Jews or Messianic Gentiles, but whatever you call yourselves, this applies to you. Okay? This applies to you. And we've talked about what's inside the camp, all right? It's important to try to take a look now at what's outside the camp. I mean, we just got an invitation to go outside the camp. Well, we know Yeshua's out there. Okay, that's in the verse, right? Go to him outside the camp. Well, we know he's there, but what else is out there? What is outside the camp? What is this image? This writer is evoking, because of his audience, evoking a very familiar image. Okay, the camp, not only the camp, but what's outside the perimeter of the camp. Let's talk about that. First of all, it was a dirty place. It was an unclean place, a profane place. It was where dirty people and dirty things went. That's what it was. Here's a few examples. And one of them's from the Torah portion this morning, but not this one. When Miriam rebelled against Moses, remember, God turned her skin leprous. What happened? She got sent outside the camp for a week. But listen to the way that this text describes what that was supposed to symbolize. It says that she should suffer the same shame as if her father spit in her face. That's what going outside the camp for a week meant. Surprisingly and interesting. But from this morning's passage, the two sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, when they offered that wrong fire up and they are killed, they drop dead, the helpers are instructed, take their dead bodies outside the camp and bury them there. So the cemetery was outside the camp. And y'all know the cemetery defiles. It's an unclean place. People with serious skin diseases had to hang out outside the camp. That's right. And it's a strange tradition, but they were supposed to keep their hair unkempt, their clothes torn, and they were supposed to, if anyone got near them, they were supposed to cover the bottoms of their faces and cry out, "Unclean, unclean," like, you know, "I'm disgusting. Don't get too close to me. Stay away. I'm warning you." So outcasts, blasphemers, Sabbath breakers, all these people were outside the camp. Okay? The refuse from the sacrifices, the leftover animal remains, you know, were chucked outside the camp. When people had to use the bathroom, where did they go? Outside the camp. Not inside the camp. I mean, we have nice facilities, you know, today. Back then, no, it was outside the camp. So outside the camp was not where you wanted to be. You don't want to go outside the camp unless you got to go to the bathroom. You know, avoid the cemetery, look out for the sick people, stay away from the blasphemers. You know, all this kind of stuff is out there. It's not a nice place. But the writer of Hebrews says, go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. Wow. Thanks very much. But it's important to see a nuance in this verse. He doesn't just say, go outside the camp. Listen carefully. He says, go out to him outside the camp. We're supposed to go to a person, not a place. Thank God for that. Yeshua the Messiah, the Holy One of Israel, who was pushed out of the community, right? I mean, he was treated that way, pushed out of the community, out of the camp. He suffered shame. He was treated as a blasphemer, as an unclean man, as a Sabbath breaker. We're told to go join him. All right? We're told to go join him. I wonder if you've ever joined him outside the camp in that way, where you've experienced that sense of being outside the camp. You know, I prayed about, I was thinking about, what am I going to share this morning? And I got the sense that I should share about what I'm talking now. And then when I came here and I was worshiping with you and I was meeting many of you, I started questioning God, like, wow, should I switch this message real fast? You know, I could pull something else out, because I don't know if this message really relates to people here. I was wondering. And then I continued to get the sense that I should continue with this and to allow you all to figure out how it applies to you. I'm not going to do that for you. So I'm just going to talk about this and allow God to speak to your hearts, because I don't know what it means to you, okay? I know what it means when, for instance, I met a guy in Los Angeles. I had been with the Ministry of Jews for Jesus a very short period of time. I don't know, maybe a couple of years or less. And I'm on the street corner in Los Angeles, and I'm handing out our broadsides or our gospel tracts. And a guy, I see him across, you know, he's waiting for the light to change. He's across the street, well-dressed, nice trim beard. I see him there. He's going to come my way. He looks real Jewish, you know. And he's coming across the street, and he comes up to me very intentionally, leans, he's right in my space, you know. And he has a business card in his hand ready, hands it to me, and he says, someday you may need to talk to someone, and when you do, give me a call. And he walks away. Boom, just like that. And his name, I remember his first name was Moshe. I can't remember the guy's last. Oh, looks like I wrote it down. Might have been Levy. Moshe Levy. And so, you know, I'm you know what a missionary is, right? So I figured, okay, yeah, I need to talk to this guy about the Lord. So I give him a call. We get together within a week or so at a coffee shop not far from where I lived. And he says, now look, before we start talking, I need to tell you, though my business card says I'm a lawyer, which I am, I'm also a rabbi. So I just, you know, full disclosure, just so you know. Okay, fine. So he starts asking me a lot of questions, and I can see real quickly he wants to know if I'm trapped in a cult, you know, and I need help extricating myself from this cult. So everybody knows Jews for Jesus is a cult, right? So, you know, so he's grilling me with a lot of questions, and he soon realizes I'm married. At that time, I now have four kids, but we had three kids back then. I'm married. I have three kids. We had a three-bedroom apartment. I have health insurance. You know, I get some vacation each year. Life isn't bad. I'm okay, you know. And I have a master's degree, you know. At that time, yeah, I had a master's in social work. Well, I still have it. But anyway, he found out I was stable. So I said, now that the kind of the air was cleared a little bit, I said, well, you know, do you mind if I ask you a few questions? He said, no, not at all. I said, well, I know you're a rabbi, so this might seem strange, but rabbi, do you believe in God? And he said, oh, no, that's not a bad question. That's a good question. He said, look, you know, during the week I work as a lawyer. Life is busy. It's hard during the week. On Shabbat, I worship, you know, I don't know if you said worship, but whatever. I'm with Chabad, you know. And I go to services. On Shabbat, yes, I believe in God. You know, the rest of the week, it's kind of tough. You know, he was honest. I appreciated his honesty. And then he said this to me. He said, look, he said, when I went to, become a rabbi, we studied a lot of stuff. And we did not study those passages that Christians say are about Jesus. He says, but on my own, I studied those. I wanted to look into it see why they believe that. He says, you know what I found? He says, I can see their case. I can see why they think it's about him. There is, a reasonable case there. He said, but I chose to go in the direction that I chose, frankly, because it's more comfortable for me. And again, I appreciated his honesty, but this was a guy who didn't want to take a step outside the camp. Taking that step outside the camp can be very painful. It can cost a lot. When I first told my parents of my faith, I was 19 years old when I became a believer in Yeshua and a follower. When I told my folks, of course, my mother started crying. She said, you're brainwashed. Somebody must have spoon-fed this stuff to you. And also, it was 1975. Does anybody know what the United Nations did in 1975? Okay. They passed a resolution that equated Zionism with racism. So it's since been repealed. But my mother said to me, and this was right after that when I told them, my mother said, Stephen, there's going to be a new wave of anti-Semitism in this country, and you're just trying to hide. So they had all these kinds of ideas. My father, his response was to say, Stephen, you have put up a wall between you and the rest of the family. There is now a wall that you have just put up there. And, of course, that hurt. And it took me a number of years, actually probably a decade or more, before I realized something about my father's statement. I realized that he was right in identifying the fact that there was a wall between us. He was wrong in saying that I put it there. Here's what I mean. The Jewish community has, in some type of sociological way, erected this wall around themselves that if you're on the inside of the walls, okay, it's a nice circle, I don't know why, but in my example it's a circle. If you're inside that circle, the camp is inside those walls. Everybody looks to the right or to the left. You Jewish? Yeah, I'm Jewish. Of course, I'm inside. Everybody inside here is Jewish. So, everybody looks around and everybody says, yeah, I'm Jewish, okay? If one person inside the walls discovers or God reveals that Yeshua is Mashiach, is Messiah, well, the weirdest thing happens. Sometimes they're thrown over the wall. Or sometimes they're shoved through the door if there's a door in the wall. But sometimes, in my imaginative, scenario, the shape of the wall changes. You're standing in the same spot, and once the wall went around you, but now the wall all of a sudden goes like that, and then woo, goes like that, and then continues. So you're on the outside of the wall. It's a strange sociological phenomenon. Oh, I'm a real Jew. You're no Jew anymore. So that wall is there, but I didn't put it there. The community has put it there over a long period of time, and those of us who traverse the wall or the shape of the wall changes, we are now outside the camp. And it's no fun. I don't like being outside the camp. Honestly, I can't believe that God called me to do what I'm doing because, number one, I really like to be accepted by people. I'm a nice guy. When I went to L.A., what time is it? Show me now. All right, fine. Doesn't matter. When I went to Los Angeles, my sister was and I only moved to Los Angeles from Chicago when I joined Jews for Jesus, okay? Which was a big bomb in my family. All right, so my sister's living in Los Angeles. I go out there, and she gets very uncomfortable to realize I'm going to be doing what I'm doing, evangelizing Jewish people in her backyard. Of course, when I told my family, my mother, when I said I'm going to apply to be on the staff, my mother said, Stephen, I hate to think of all the pain you'll be causing families. And then she said, I hate to think of you on a street corner like those Hare Krishnas. I said, Mom, don't. I said, Mom, don't worry, we don't dance. But my sister got so uncomfortable that she got involved with Jews for Judaism. There's a guy out there, Rabbi Ben Sion Kravitz. She started going to his support groups and Shabbatons and different things. And interestingly, what happened was in these support groups for families who had a family member that were, you know, trapped in the cult, in that support group, my name came up very frequently because I actually had a ministry to any number of the people, the family members of those who were coming to that group. And of course, you can't be a nice guy if you're the enemy, if you're the one causing the family pain, if you're the Jewish evangelist, in a sense, the Jewish missionary to Jewish people. You are not, by definition, a nice guy. You cannot be. So you can only demonize that person. So I was demonized in that group. I was never there, but my sister ultimately told me. And she said, and I appreciate her for this, that she said to them, No, you don't know my brother. You know, my brother's not like that. And my brother this and my brother that. And ultimately, she had to leave that group because it was just too much of an inner conflict for her. And it was very, very tough. But let me broaden this out before we bring this to a close. I'm not really going to go. We already missed lunch. We're not going to miss dinner. yeah. A lot of you have heard of Ami Ortiz, right? The teenager in Israel who was blown up, right, because his family's messianic. Okay. Maybe many of you have not heard of a guy named Rami, all right? Rami is not a messianic Jew. Rami he's no longer living. He was a Christian, Palestinian Christian, who had been came from a Muslim background. There's a little booklet out now in Hebrew called Ami V'Rami, and it's got both of their stories side by side. Ami Ortiz, we know, was blown up, and most of us know that story. Rami, this Palestinian Christian, he was in charge. He was the manager of the, I don't know whose Bible shop it was, but a Bible shop in the Gaza Strip. And he kept getting threatened, and finally he was murdered, okay? And he had definitely gone outside the camp from his cultural starting place, which was Muslim. He had become a believer in Yeshua as Mashiach. This isn't a Jewish, solely a Jewish reality. Happens with the Muslim. Happens with the Hindus. Do you know that? Happens with them too. Here's a very interesting story. You've heard of the untouchables? The lowest of the lowest of the lowest in the caste system in India, which in theory they're trying to do away with. I don't think they really are, but the untouchables, their jobs, they can only deal with dead bodies or clean up excrement. I mean, that's the kind of rank you are in society. Very similar to, you know, they are outside the camp of their society in India. They live out there. Well, there was an Indian Christian who decided to leave India to get education in the West. He did that. He went back and he remembered from his youth that there was some village that had a church there, and he went there on Christmas Day. This is a true story. I know the guy who heard it firsthand. And he went there and he looked around and there was no church. And he couldn't figure it out. And then he found an old man somehow, and there was an old man there, and he asked him, "Wasn't there a church here? What happened?" And the old guy explained to him, "Yes, there was, but our pastor died, and we didn't know what to do. and it was a village of untouchables. And he says, we didn't know what to do. So, you know, we closed the door and that was it. And then he said, well, wait just a moment. So the guy waited and the old guy went somewhere and dug out from the ground this clay pot. And he said, for a long time, we didn't know what to do, but we kept giving, you know, a little bit of money, as was our practice, for the Lord and his work. And we put it in this jar, and then we buried it, thinking someday, you know, someday God will use it somehow. So he said, here it is. Maybe you can tell us what to do with this. Yeah, talk about it. So this guy decided that he would make his life there among the untouchables. And now, I first heard this story in the 90s, all right? Probably the late 90s. And at that time, this guy had started a movement where there were 50,000 untouchables who had come to faith in Yeshua through this very humble beginning. Those people, because they, in essence, live outside the camp, they didn't really have to worry about, you know, what do they have to lose? What do they have to lose? It's a great way to come to the Lord. And it's the way we really all kind of should come to the Lord, right? What have I got to lose? But Yeshua knows that we do have things to lose. And he often said that, right? You know, unless you give up this, unless you, you know, hey, don't worry about your this relationship, you know, and things change. We sometimes our gain involves a loss. Think about the blind guy in chapter 9 of John's gospel. All right? If you recall the story, it's one of my favorite stories, but Yeshua heals this man who was born blind, and through that he becomes the subject of community gossip. Everybody's talking about, is this the guy? Is this the guy? No, I don't think so. He kind of looks like him, and there's all this community gossip. Then the religious leaders come to him, and they start giving him the third degree. So he starts to experience a lot of pressure from the religious leaders, from the Jewish communal leaders. Okay, then they say, well, let's bring you to your parents. You know, so they go to the parents, and what do the parents do? Instead of supporting their son, they're nervous, they're afraid, and they say, you know what? We know that's our son. We know he was born blind, but what happened, how he sees all this miracle stuff, we don't know. Ask him. He's old enough. Just ask him. So the poor guy doesn't get support from his family. He doesn't get it from the community. His life is turned upside down. It's almost like this blessing of being healed becomes a curse in his life. He loses. You know, if you read the story, he's kicked out of the synagogue. He loses his place in the community. His family is alienated. He's a subject of gossip. Thank you very much. You know, this blessing became in many ways a very hurtful curse. I want to close with this, because there's more to that story that I don't want to leave out. All right? Because Yeshua heard what happened to the guy in John chapter 9. He hears that he was kicked out of the synagogue, and he doesn't get the disciples together and say, oh, wow, guys, let's have a prayer meeting for poor, you know, Shmuel who got kicked out. Or let's quick take a letter, Maria, and, you know, we'll send it to him, some kind of condolence letter or a sympathy card. No, it says that Yeshua, when he heard he was kicked out, it says he went and finding him is the beginning of the sentence, dot, dot, dot. So Yeshua heard that this guy had paid a price. He was definitely outside the camp. He had been kicked out of the camp, paid a price, and Yeshua goes and finds him and then has a personal interaction with him. If I was filming it, I think Yeshua would put his arm around the guy and, you know, really encourage him. But in that little bit of a conversation, what you see there is that Yeshua actually reveals more of his identity to this guy. The guy realizes in that moment who Yeshua fully is and who he truly is. So I want to just say to you, and you apply this where it fits. You know, I don't know where in your lives, if ever, you feel outside the camp. I mean, do you speak to people about the Lord and experience ridicule sometimes? Or that you're the butt of gossip? Or family members, because of your zeal at times, you know, they say something painful and you experience tears. You know, I don't know. Or maybe you're so quiet about your faith, you're exuberant here and you leave here and you're just kind of quiet about it and you don't really experience ever being outside the camp because everything's usually nice and level and copacetic. I don't know what, you know, how it fits for you, but if you're the one who has shed some tears, you got to read Psalm 56. God says he collects your tears in a bottle. When we do our evangelism campaigns in Jews for Jesus, we bring volunteers with us. You know, some of those volunteers are Jewish. Some of them are not Jewish. And some of them have never done anything like that before in their life, to speak to people on their lunch breaks or as in the rush hour and, you know, try to. And the responses and the reactions they get sometimes bruise them, you know. And hey, look, I've been in ministry now for 24 years. They still sometimes bruise me. You know, we don't become Iron Man when Yeshua was not Iron Man. If he was Iron Man, he wouldn't have bled. You know, if he was Iron Man, they couldn't have got the nails through him. So we're very human as he was human, and it hurts sometimes. So I remember, you know, volunteers crying, and this one girl named Sherry, I was with her. She was trying to share God's love, and somebody went off on her, you know, in a big way. And I remember her crying. And as I thought about it, I realized that if that had been Yeshua himself instead of our volunteer Sherry, he could not have done better than she did. What I mean is, she didn't run away. She didn't answer back in anger. She stood there like the blind man, hurting but still proud to be identified with Yeshua. And when that happens to you, when you are reminded by something that happens in your lives that, wow, I'm outside the camp, I want you to look around at that moment. At that moment, not this moment. But if you do, I mean, if you're in a public place or in some way, look around, God will show you that you're not alone out there. That there are other believers already there outside the camp, and they are there to pray with you, to encourage you. A lot of times when I take it on the chin, you know, almost immediately God sends a kind of a real enthusiastic, warm-hearted believer, and, you know, to pray with me. It's real interesting how that oftentimes happens. But more than finding other believers outside the camp there, if you have your eyes peeled, yeah, that's right, you'll see Yeshua out there with you. How do I know that? The text tells us he was out there before you were. He was out there before you. He's waiting for you to come to him out there, outside the camp. Let me close with something he said in Matthew. He said, we know this from the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Yeshua tells us we're blessed. All I can do is echo his words and say, you are the blessed when that happens to you. Let me close with a word of prayer. Avinu shebashamayim, anachnu modim lecha. We thank you that you are here. We thank you that you went first. You did it all, but that you're outside the camp before us, enduring that shame and that reproach. And you're doing pretty well with it. You're doing amazing. Lord, you are beyond words. You are, we could have a whole nother praise service right now because that's how awesome you are. But Lord, I pray for my brothers and sisters here that you will strengthen us, including myself, to do the work you've called us to do. And to dwell with you, live our lives with you in some very real way outside the camp. Because we know someday we'll be in that city that does endure. We'll be in that camp that's forever, where we don't have to worry about being outside the walls because we'll be inside for all time. But for now, Lord, help us do what you want us to do outside the camp. I pray, B'Shem Yeshua Mashiachenu, in the name of Jesus, our Messiah. Amen.